Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Colm O'Mungine, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
This week, we'll take a hard look at the Tory leadership contest and how the focus has shifted from Boris Johnson's concerned neighbours to Britain's concerned neighbour. Yes, Ireland. It's all there. The Irish border, no deal, the backstop, and they're all back in the Tory crosshairs.
We'll hear the latest on the campaign from RTE's London correspondent Fiona Mitchell. We'll assess the revival of alternative arrangements on that big report this week on how technology, administrative fixes and EU and WTO exemptions would mean the backstop would never be needed.
What exactly is the Alternative Arrangements Commission and who is in it? And how did Ireland react to some of the ideas which Boris Johnson has described as brilliant?
And just over midway between the March 29th deadline and the October 31st deadline, is Ireland starting to feel the heat from other member states on what it plans to do at the border if there is a no-deal scenario? But first, Fiona, there's nothing like having concerned neighbours looking out for you, or rather listening into you and recording what they listen. Tell us about what occurred with Boris Johnson, because he's not telling anyone about it.
Yes, they say good fences make good neighbours, and I suspect that this week Boris Johnson had been hoping that there had would have been more of a fence between him and his neighbours, because this time last week it looked like this was going to be a relatively staid campaign, relatively straightforward, everybody getting a sense of where it was going, but it was the events of last Thursday night into Friday morning which really kind of changed the tone of this completely. Newspapers starting to run with reports that the police had been called to reports of an altercation at the home that Boris Johnson shares with his girlfriend Carrie Symonds. Now, obviously, that ran in all of the newspapers on Saturday morning. The neighbours were alleged to have heard an argument, a very loud argument, taking place between the couple. They said that they heard shouts and yelling, and they heard what sounded like things being thrown. They went to the door, knocked several times, but got no response, and eventually called the police. Now, as part of all of this, they also recorded some of the arguing. This is the virtue, if you will, of living in London, where very often you're living in old converted houses, in apartment blocks, things like that, and you can hear a lot of what is going on with the neighbours and between the walls and upstairs and downstairs. Now, obviously, Saturday morning was the day of the first hustings in this campaign. Saturday morning's headlines were just about the worst news that there could have been for the Boris Johnson campaign, and what they essentially said was they were making absolutely no comment on this. Boris Johnson doesn't talk about his private life, and that isn't going to change. But it was the story column that simply did not go away, because of course it played in to all of the questions that had already been getting asked about
character and Boris trust
Johnson's
and all of these
character,
things.
His colourful private life, all the euphemisms that were being used, trust issues. Is this the kind of man you want to trust the country with? So of course it played into all of that, and he did sort of double down on that idea of I'm simply not going to talk about this, really dodged the question when he was asked about it in the hustings, got quite a bit of cheering and support, it must be said, and quite a bit of laughter from the Conservative Party members who were gathered at that first hustings in Birmingham, but also shouts of answer the question from people in the audience. So clearly, as I say, this was not the way you want to start a campaign like this, and his team really, after a couple of days, it hadn't gone away and they knew they were going to have to start doing something.
Well, he was being prodded and poked and accused of cowardice by Jeremy Hunt. He eventually did do a range of media interviews, one with Laura Koonsberg. The first, I think, he broke his silence with Laura Koonsberg on the BBC. And then he went on and did one on LBC and another on talk radio as well. Overall, what was the impression of those interviews? There were some strange ramblings in some and some fairly combative assertions in the other. How have they been analysed in the aftermath in London? And we'll get Tony's take on how they went down in Brussels in a moment.
Well, part of the difficulty, of course, with these is that the feeling was that they came about because suddenly the Johnson campaign was on the back foot. He was being, chided by his opponent, Jeremy Hunt, for not coming out and talking, didn't take part in a proposed Sky News debate on Tuesday night. And there was a clear sense that this campaign strategy of we're just not going to do that much press at all and we're going to say very little, given the events of the weekend, that wasn't something that was going to be able to hold. I mean, you know, taunts of, you know, he's a coward and if he can't come out and debate things with me, how is he going to be able to actually run the country? Those were hurting him. And so he knew that there was going to have to be something done to tackle it. But once he did and he started that round of interviews, I mean, as you say, it was slightly all over the shop at times. He did that first interview with Laura Koonsberg on Tuesday evening. He talked about, very serious issues like Brexit, his proposals, his plans on Brexit, what he hoped would happen, what he hoped to do. But as he continued through those interviews over the course of Tuesday and Wednesday, you could see his position start to vacillate a little bit. I mean, on Tuesday, it was literally do or die. That was the phrase that he used and the phrase that could potentially come back to haunt him. It was do or die that the UK would be leaving the EU on October 31st. I mean, he rather unfortunately, Colm, used a phrase from the poem The Charge of the Light Brigade by Alfred Lord Tennyson. When you dig down into it, the imagery may not very well be the best if this is a phrase that comes back at him in a couple of months' time. The passage comes from "Someone had blundered, theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die, into the valley of death rode the 600. So it certainly wasn't the most upbeat of messages to send. So that was Tuesday, it was do or die. On Wednesday then, it was that there's a million to one chance of the UK leaving the EU without a deal. So straight away you see that moving from one position to another, which is going to confuse people. Now, he has always maintained October 31st is that deadline, but we have seen him move a little bit away from that when he uses phrases like, oh, it's eminently feasible, not that it's an absolute.
There is a perception, at least, isn't there, that since he first used eminently feasible some time ago, that there has been a hardening of the position within his camp. Ian Duncan Smith has now been promoted to as a chair of his campaign.
And that's right, yes.
There seem to be greater European research group, the Eurosceptic group within the Tory party, greater influence by them, and talk of pressure behind the scenes on Boris Johnson to harden his position or lose the support of the ERG.
Yes, and also this week it worked out quite well for Boris Johnson's campaign, if you like, because it could be used, that October 31st deadline could be used in a very clear way to draw those battle lines with Jeremy Hunt on Brexit and to draw this away from Boris Johnson's private life and to focus back on the big issue of Brexit. Because, of course, Jeremy Hunt has said, well, he might be prepared to look at a delay beyond October 31st. So dragging it all back to that very much got the agenda setting kind of Brexit October 31st deadline that Boris Johnson wants. That is much safer ground for him. Those are the kind of places he wants to be talking and talking about. But also, obviously, as you say, Ian Duncan Smith taking over running his campaign, a sense now that that's the direction that he's moving in, much more of a hardening of a position on that. The difficulty for Boris Johnson is that he has brought people on from both sides of the party. He has the hard Brexiteers in the ERG, but he also has more moderate MPs who see him as the way forward for the Conservative Party. they believe that he is the answer to the difficulties and the controversies that the party has been going through, and that potentially he is the saviour of the party. But that does not mean that they want a no-deal Brexit on October 31st. No. They don't. So he's trying to find a way through both of those. And I mean, as Theresa May proved time and again, that's not really possible. But that is a stance that he certainly has to continue during the course of this campaign, because anything else would cause him serious difficulties with the Conservative Party members that are voting in this election.
Now, one of the things that we touched on in the podcast last week was part of the grand plan, apart from alternative arrangements, which we'll again get to in a moment with Tony, but there's this GAT24 clause which got him in hot water. Liam Fox, the Trade Secretary, who's backing Jeremy Hunt, was out last Sunday and said GAT24 doesn't mean that Britain can leave with no deal on the 31st of October, as Boris Johnson is saying it is, with no tariffs between the EU and the UK. The veneer, the wheels, the paint, whatever you like to call it, has been coming off that particular idea. To put it back in Tennyson's words, it's cannons to the left of it and cannons to the right.
Yes, that Article 24, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which has been so talked about this week, that essentially a forerunner to the WTO and offers a way to avoid tariffs and border restrictions if the UK leaves the EU without a deal, is the argument of Boris Johnson's camp. Their argument is that it would let WTO members in trade discussions look more favourably, essentially, on one another. But the difficulty with it is that GAT24 provision can't be unilaterally invoked or provoked. And so the EU, it would seem, is a lot less likely to agree to it because, quite frankly, if you have left without a deal, you have left without a deal, not simply reverting back to something else. And there's a lot of arguing as to whether or not it is feasible. And we've seen over the course of the last couple of days, the head of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, essentially saying, look, this is not going to work. And GAT24 is not a runner. You mentioned Liam Fox as well, also saying the same thing, saying, look, this is just not a way forward on this. And Mark Carney once again yesterday saying, look, it is simply not going to work. And obviously Mark Carney is somebody who would be a major player in something like this. So perhaps even that suggests that there are the difficulties ahead that Boris Johnson would have with those that he will need to have on side in the event of him pursuing a no-deal Brexit. And that's before you even get to the idea of whether a no-deal Brexit is going to be feasible because of MPs. And we'll talk about that a bit later, because right, there is actually going to be another attempt on Tuesday to stop the idea of a no-deal Brexit.
OK, well, let's go to Brussels. Tony, what's the general view in Brussels been of the debate, particularly on things like GAT24 and talk of alternative arrangements that you can glean?
Yeah, I mean, people are watching the debate at the moment with the usual blend of fascination, people being flabbergasted at some of the claims of Boris Johnson. I mean, people tend to now view this GAT24 debate as something akin to, you know, religious devotion, you know, people taking extremely doctrinaire views, swearing blind that they're right and the other is wrong. I mean, we had Bill Cash, a veteran Eurosceptic, saying on Twitter all week that anybody who said that GAT24 couldn't be used was simply wrong, and he retweeted a letter from a group of economists and commentators to that effect. Boris Johnson himself, of course, saying that it would make perfect sense for the EU to invoke GAT24 because, sure, look, there's been unbroken trade between Britain and the EU for 40 years. Well, it was broken by Brexit, I guess, so the view here is somewhat jaundiced about that argument. I mean, some of the things that Boris Johnson has suggested, like disaggregating the withdrawal agreement, are greeted with eye rolling. And
is it regarded just as a smokescreen, a sort of a complicated usine of gas, as Michel Barnier once called another idea, just a complex machinery to throw out there as a holding position during the debate that can't be interrogated too closely because it just can mean so many things to so many people?
Well, there's certainly a feeling that the ideas and the contradictions that are emanating from the Johnson camp at the moment are redolent of some of the initial ideas that came out in the immediate aftermath of the referendum in 2016, when people were just coming to grips with the enormity of the result and really didn't understand that much about world trade rules, about the EU single market, about the customs union, and people were suggesting one bilateral fix after another. And there's a bit of a whiff of that. There's also a feeling that Boris Johnson is deliberately raising the stakes so that when he comes, or if and when he comes to Brussels with some of these ideas about taking out the nice bits of the withdrawal agreement, ditching the backstop, going for alternative arrangements, also kicking the Irish border question, you know, into the long grass and dealing with it when you dealt with a new trade agreement, and also the fact that he was talking about a standstill transition period or implementation period after no deal. I mean, none of these things actually make any sense to people here in Brussels. And there's a feeling that perhaps he's just deliberately raising these stakes so that when he gets rebuffed, then he can blame the EU for, bad faith and not wanting to explore creative solutions to avoid a no-deal Brexit. And part of the alternative arrangements approach, it kind of feeds into that. We can discuss now this Alternative Arrangements Commission, which published its big report this week on Monday in London. And that was a fairly interesting venture, I think, just in terms of the people, the personnel of this Alternative Arrangements Commission.
Well, that's it. Tell us who's on it, what it is and what it proposes.
Well, it was launched by a Tory donating multimillionaire hedge fund donor called Sir Paul Marshall, who has supported Brexit, and he has put a lot of money into creating this vehicle called Prosperity UK. Now, it's pretty widely held that this is a group of people who are predominantly tilted towards the Eurosceptic end of the spectrum and who are frankly alarmed at the idea of global Britain, of Britain having an independent trade policy, of that being in any way shackled by the backstop and Britain being held back in its, buccaneering global ambitions because of the Irish border. So he has pulled together a technical panel of lawyers and academics and border experts and customs and trade experts. He also has a large parliamentary commission of MPs who tend to number quite a few members of the ERG, the DUP. It does have a reputation of being very much on the Eurosceptic side of the spectrum, but the two leading lights are Tory MPs who voted Remain, actually, Greg Hands and Nicky Morgan. So what they've done is they've drawn up a very big interim report, and they have talked about how the Irish backstop issue could be headed off at the pass, if you like, by alternative arrangements. To be fair to them, they have visited Ireland. They've done, I think, four separate trips to Northern Ireland. They've tried a certain amount of outreach to the official authorities in Dublin, I think with varying degrees of success. Some of the trade organisations and the employers organisations in Dublin have politely declined invitations to talk to them. I think the Irish government have not been all that keen to get involved with them formally. But they have come up with this big paper saying that essentially, there are lots of ways to make the border as fluid as possible. You can use technology, you can use what they call special economic zones. They talked about a special economic zone around Derry, Donegal, and one around Newry and Dundalk, where you would have, a 30-kilometre buffer on each side where there was completely free trade in the middle. But, obviously you'd have to cross a border to get into that buffer zone in the first place. You know, a lot of stuff which, they say this already exists with a bit of will. It technology can improve all these things. And essentially, you can piece together multiple layers of solutions that will take away the need for the backstop, avoid that problem, that deadlock in the House of Commons, and of course get around this, long-standing unionist objection to the backstop. But of course, I mean, the first thing to say is that the whole point of the backstop isn't that it's just dealing with the efficiencies or otherwise of trade and checks and controls at the border. It's that the whole economic model of the all-island economy and the cross-border supply chains and so on that largely deal in agri-food, that those would simply be uneconomic, even if you had all these efficiencies at a border and so on.
what there is another issue as well of, is it a special sanitary and phytosanitary zone that would leave Ireland closely aligned with the UK, a kind of an inversion of the backstop when it comes to sanitary and phytosanitary checks within the alternative arrangements? What's that?
Yeah, this was, I think, the most startling suggestion of all. And to be fair to them again, they've posited various solutions, and this would be one of them, although they have suggested that, you know, this could have problems. But if we isolate the whole issue of the problem at the Irish border, the problem is that you would have Northern Ireland, if it's outside the single market and customs union, you would have tariffs on goods. And you would have very important and sensitive regulatory checks on food, on animals, on live animals, on animal products. And that's really why this is such a big issue, because so much of that cross-border trade is focused on those kind of sectors. Now, if you have Northern Ireland outside, then you're going to have checks. For example, the UK as a whole was in some kind of single sanitary and phytosanitary food safety area and joined with the island of Ireland in some kind of new regulatory area, then it would mean that you would not need checks going between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, nor would you need checks on goods going back and forward over the Irish border. Now, the first thing that springs to mind is, well, if the UK is going to be outside the EU and outside the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice and the whole monitoring regime that makes sure all these rules apply and are respected, then how's that going to work? I mean, that essentially means Ireland would have to pull out of the EU single market when it comes to, you know, food safety and agri-food. And as someone said to me, look, this is the segmentation of the EU single market. It just simply is not going to fly for a minute.
How have these alternative arrangements been greeted in the British media? Are they a subject of intense debate and scrutiny, and are they being treated seriously, or are they being dismissed along with GATT24 as more of the same and confusion and smokescreen? What's been the take?
Well, there's a sense of really we have been here before, and that they're hearing a lot of phrases, you know, technological solutions that have been there and that have been dismissed by the EU in the past. So I think at this point, having 3 years on from that Brexit vote and having been around the houses so many times, there was a sense from many that, you know, they might, during the course of this race, actually start to hear new phrases and new ideas. And there's a huge sense of this really being a reheat of what has gone before, and not a huge sense that it is necessarily something that is going to work, because it is obviously something that is in the gift of the EU to say yes or no to. And if they've already said no, well, it looks unlikely that they're going to change, particularly if they get a new prime minister, and that might not necessarily be somebody that they would be as keen to do favours for, shall we say. So there's a lot of that sense of both of the candidates in this race still facing exactly the same problems that Theresa May did, still facing the same difficulties. In the case of Boris Johnson, many would say he's also facing those difficulties, but with less goodwill than there might have been for his predecessor, and a lot of worry over what exactly might happen, and really a lot of talk but not necessarily an awful lot of clarity about how either Jeremy Hunt or Boris Johnson proposes to get through this.
Well,
I would just make one clarification actually on this whole alternative arrangements issue, because it's important to stress that this report and this Alternative Arrangements Commission is pretty much a freelance operation, funded, as we say, by a particular individual. Now, although they do have a lot of MPs on board, and they have two prominent Conservative MPs who are heading it up, it's not an official government, UK government position or organisation. So that's why you didn't get any official response either from the European Commission on this or indeed from the Irish government. Now, there is an alternative arrangements approach by the EU and the UK government, but it's part of the withdrawal agreement, and it foresees both sides trying to explore as far as possible what alternative arrangements on technology and facilitations might yield in the context of the Irish border with certain target dates like December 2020. But again, that work can only take effect if and when the withdrawal agreement is ratified.
In terms of coverage in Britain of Europe, so take, for example, what you're talking about there, Tony, on alternative arrangements. There still seems to be hope expressed that Germany is amenable to this on behalf of its automotive industry. Germany is amenable to cutting the deal, that people just need to be positive, believe in Brexit, so to speak, and that the Germans would be amenable to alternative arrangements. What's your understanding of it in Brussels, Tony?
Yes, I mean, there is, of course, a lot of focus on Brexit and the prospect of no deal. I think in most people's minds has increased. There's no doubt about it. The tone and temper of the Tory leadership debate has certainly raised the prospect of no deal. And I think that has certainly put the spotlight back on Ireland. Now, we all remember leading up to the end of March, Leo Varadkar was getting a lot of uncomfortable questions about, well, what are you going to do on the Irish border if there is no deal? And of course, the government's mantra had always been that they were not preparing to put up a hard border, but yet they were still somehow going to uphold the integrity of the single market. So how could you reconcile those two things? Now, obviously, March 29th came and went, two extensions were granted, and those kind of pressures somewhat dissipated. But now, you know, as I say, we're halfway through the period between end of March and end of October. The debate in the UK seems to have elevated no deal to a much more clear and present danger. So I think the focus is coming back to Ireland. There was a report in the Daily Telegraph during the week that there was a gang of six member states who were putting pressure on Ireland to provide details as to how they would operationalise checks and controls at the Irish border in a no-deal situation. The Taoiseach, Simon Coveney, spokesman, was obliged to put out a statement saying, look, the EU and Ireland are focused on avoiding a hard border, on protecting the peace process and upholding the single market and customs union, and we continue to work with the Commission on that front. Now, I've been looking at this quite a bit in the past few days, and there have been more questions asked about what Ireland's going to do at the border. Some of these questions are being raised at informal groupings of member states who are most affected by Brexit, and these are meetings that take place in various capitals. Some of them are fairly informal. At some of the more formal structures in Brussels, questions are being asked as well. But my overall impression is that this is not in any sense Ireland being put under pressure. It is simply, I suppose, a reminder that, well, look, you know, we'll need to know at some point what you're going to do. We have 3.5 months or whatever, 3 months left until the end of October. You will kind of need to use that time to put a plan in place with the European Commission. Now, details on no-deal planning in the Irish border are extremely difficult to come across, but the overall impression I'm getting is that there will not be a detailed contingency plan in place until day one of no deal. It is that sensitive for the Irish government, and there is universal understanding, I think, among the member states, or at least most of the member states, as to why Ireland needs to keep its cards very close to its chest on this issue.
But why is that? So the working assumption of the Irish government at the moment, or the working hope of the Irish government at the moment, is that the withdrawal agreement will in some way be ratified and we'll be into the stage of the future relationship between the EU and the UK being negotiated, and will hopefully involve an arrangement whereby no border will be needed, or the backstop will be able to kick in. If the working assumption in Europe is now that they're on no deal high alert, and if that's the concern within the UK as well, what is wrong with preparing for a no deal scenario? Or is it the view that anything the Irish do to prepare for a hard border on the island of Ireland will be seized upon on the UK side and pointed towards as this is how manageable a hard Brexit is. The Irish are putting facilitation in place. Is that the balance that has to be
struck? It's essentially a bit of a Hobson's choice for the government. I mean, if they are entirely reticent and unforthcoming on how they're going to uphold the single market and the customs union at their frontier with what will be a third country, then they will no doubt alienate and discomfort other member states who have, for their own reasons, a very strong incentive for a proper control at the Irish border to be established. If they start to get into detail as to what they can and will do at the border, then it runs the risk of being immediately seized upon by people like Boris Johnson or even Jeremy Hunt or Brexiteers in general, who will say, well, there you are, you see, all along these facilitations were available. The Irish government is now working on details of these facilitations. So what's the problem? Why the need for the backstop? This has always, I think, been the dilemma for the Irish government. And certainly, you know, people I speak to from different member states understand that completely. And they are, I suppose, creating and are prepared to give Ireland quite a bit of legroom on this. But the trouble is that the closer we get to the end of October, and if there is no deal, I think the more pressure will build on Ireland. But as I say, the impression I'm getting is that we will not see detailed contingency plans fleshed out until day one of a no-deal era.
Right, and no immediate pressure to do so. Fiona, the view of Ireland within the UK, but just to go back, I suppose, to some of the stories that have appeared about the great hope for Germany coming to the rescue at the last moment on behalf of its automotive industry, the coverage of there being pressure on Ireland, and then the view of Ireland itself. What's the coverage of that been like in the UK? What's the state of the debate on how the actors in Europe will bring pressure to bear on Ireland, and indeed the role of Ireland within the European Union? How has it been covered from your end?
Well, I think really the focus of so much at the moment is on that Conservative Party leadership race, and everything that goes on around that is sort of essentially how will each of those candidates, if they make it into number 10, how will they deal with the situation in terms of the Northern Ireland border? And so a huge amount of the debate here about the backstop and about all of the issues that we've been hearing about for so long goes through the prism of how might those two different characters take all of these arguments back to Europe, and what kind of solutions might they be able to find. And certainly in what we've heard from them in the first hustings and in debates and in discussions and interviews over the last couple of days, as I say, there's been a return time and again to the same old discussions that we've seen before. So there isn't a sense that either of the candidates is coming in with something that is so hugely new and different. And so it's as somebody said to me recently, it's the same old in relation to the Northern Ireland backstop. But it's also the same old, if you like, in relation to how that might be resolved, because neither of the candidates are necessarily saying that they will bring anything new to the table. Now, Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson both talk about the idea of being able to renegotiate in some way, be able to get some sort of a new deal. I mean, essentially, Boris Johnson wanting to, as he terms it, disaggregate the old withdrawal treaty, which, when you break that down, seems to be pick out the bits we like from it and put aside the bits we don't like.
Classic cakeism.
Exactly, classic.
Picking out the raisins.
Classic. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Picking out the raisins and just trying to eat the cake that is left around it. But the reality is that even, and I mean, that is a huge, huge if around getting any sort of new deal. I mean, it's almost a non-existent if. The reality is that time on all of this is so short. I mean, the clock is ticking. Those words of Donald Tusk, do not waste this time, when that extension was actually agreed. I mean, even if something was agreed now, today, right this afternoon, there's simply not enough time to get all of the legislation through. We know that, of course, we're facing into a summer break. There had been talk about whether or not that summer break might be shortened, might it be put aside completely. That hasn't happened. So at the end of July, MPs will go away and they won't be back until early September. At that point, now you are on the cusp of that new Halloween deadline. And that's why so many MPs are getting very, very concerned with with all of the talk about a no-deal Brexit and really the expectation that the winner of this contest is going to be Boris Johnson, and that he is committing to that October 31st deadline. Those MPs who just are appalled at the idea of a no-deal Brexit hardening their stance about ways in which they could try and get it off the table. Now,
yeah, upstanding and respectable members of the Conservative Party talking about open revolt and voting against the government.
Yes, I mean, people like Ken Clark, people like Dominic Grieve, you know, I mean, people like that talking about the idea of if they were faced with a no-deal Brexit or if they were faced with the idea of bringing down the government, would they actually go as far as to vote against the government? And certainly some of them suggesting that that might be a way that they would feel that they've been forced into. I mean, a couple of weeks back, you had MPs looking at ways in which they could kind of legislatively try and block no deal. Now, that was a Labour motion which would have started allowing MPs to take control of Commons business to try and block a no-deal Brexit. That was defeated by very little, it must be said, but it was still defeated. And now what you see is before that summer break looms, MPs coming back to try and do this again. And Tuesday is going to be a key day for that, because Dominic Grieve, that former Attorney General that I mentioned there, and also Dame Margaret Beckett, the Labour politician, they've both tabled an amendment on Tuesday, which is looking at another way to see if they could change the aspect of a no deal. Basically, what it would do is it would cut off cash to a number of government departments, so the communities and local government department, international development, housing, education, and every couple of months or every 6 months, MPs have to approve government spending. And what they're essentially saying is, look, we won't approve that government spending for those departments. We won't give them funding in the event of a no-deal Brexit unless it has specifically been approved by MPs. So MPs would have to vote to support no-deal, or you would essentially cut off cash. I mean, to areas like education and housing, that would be a really big thing. So this is another way that they're trying to look at that on Tuesday. Now, again, of course, whether it might be successful or not, we don't yet know. But it is clear that they are looking at every option they have to still remain in this and to make sure that whoever walks through the door of number 10 at the end of July isn't going to have all the power to put what MPs want aside once and for all. I mean, there is a real sense of that showdown looming in September.
And the word prorogue entirely gone, unless of course it's used to designate whether or not you support Boris Johnson.
Well, not entirely gone, because Dominic Raab, who was a big fan of that word and has now come on side with the Johnson campaign, Dominic Raab out talking about proroguing Parliament again this week.
All right,
I mean, Boris Johnson said that he's not a fan of it, but certainly not being a fan of it doesn't necessarily completely remove it from the agenda. So I think it's not being mentioned as much, Colin, but I think you might be hearing it again in the next couple of months.
OK, so Tuesday, the big day in London. Tony, there's a summit in Brussels this Sunday that I'll be travelling to myself, but that's about filling the top jobs. And they said definitely not really about Brexit the last time around, but this one probably definitely not about Brexit.
Yes, yeah, so they've called the heads of government back on Sunday to Brussels, because at the summit last week they couldn't even come close to getting agreement on the top jobs, notably the president of the European Commission. So they've all had to come back this Sunday to try and have another go at it. Feeling there is that it'll be a long, late one into the night. Sorry to say, Colm, I'll be away in London.
Thanks for that.
And I'll breeze back into Brussels on Monday morning, refreshed and ready to take the baton from your good self. As they get the result. Then, of course, on Tuesday and I think Wednesday, we'll have the first plenary of the brand new European Parliament. All 751 MEPs who were elected are invited to gather to formally constitute the new European Parliament, including all of those Brexit Party MEPs who want to make their mark, but of course as well all the new Irish MEPs who've been coming in dribs and drabs to Brussels. I've met a few of them here so far. They're coming,
yeah, some of them former Oireachtas members. The Your Politics podcast, which people can get on the RTÉ website, are covering that particular thing of people who are leaving the Oireachtas to become MEPs, so people can hear about that in detail in this week's Your Politics podcast.
Yeah, and of course the significance of the Well, one of the significances of the plenary session in Strasbourg next week is whether or not the Parliament can unite behind a candidate for President of the Commission if they've got that far. And of course, that's why the heads of government are meeting on Sunday. They want to try and get their hands and fingerprints on this before the Parliament tries to, you know, grab the reins of this whole process. But yeah, it seems, you know, without getting into the detail of all the different candidates, it seems it's still a pretty tricky process with no clear winner, looking like they can command the support of both the Parliament and the European Council.
Okay, well, that's our lot for this week. From me, Colm O'Mungoyne, RTE's Deputy Foreign Editor in Dublin.
And from me, Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe Editor in Brussels.
And from me, RTE's outgoing London correspondent in London. This will be my last appearance on the podcast.
Last day tomorrow.
No.
Oh, you're off for a big one in Manchester tomorrow, is it?
That's it.
Tomorrow being Friday, for anyone listening today, Thursday.
That's right. The Taoiseach travelling to the British-Irish Council meeting, that taking place in Manchester. And then he's meeting with representatives of Enterprise Ireland. So we can imagine lots of things on the agenda. Brexit, of course, but also Rockall, no doubt going to be mentioned as well, with the representatives of the Scottish government there. So a busy day for my final day.
All right. Well,
well, Fiona, we both wish you enormous success in your next role back in Dublin, and congratulations on your exhaustive and exhausting coverage of Brexit from College Green and all other points of the Westminster compass. You did a fantastic job, and we're all very proud of you. Yeah. And wish you all the best. And
Thank you so much.
Fitting in your podcast contributions from cloakrooms, bathrooms, back of Ubers.
Back of taxis. Yeah, that's it.
Thanks very much for that. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
We'll leave it there.
Thanks for listening.